You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Hi, I'm Elisa Poteet, and welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA's Standing Committee on Law and National Security. So it's a really good time to be talking tonight about ByteDance / TikTok. And our guest tonight is Glenn Gerstle. And we've had him on before. He is the former general counsel of the National Security Agency, who is now a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where he writes about the intersection of technology and national security. And since I last spoke to Glenn, there have been significant developments in the TikTok / national security space. Now, just to recap, TikTok is a Chinese-created company, and it has a corporate presence, but it's owned by ByteDance, which is headquartered, it says, in the Cayman Islands, I learned this week when I read the 92 pages of an opinion by Judge Srinivasan of the DC Circuit. And TikTok, I'm sure you know, but just to recap, is a social media platform and advertising platform. And it specializes in short form videos that are, in a word, addictive. So addictive that TikTok has been accused of using its algorithmic secret sauce to help the Kremlin install a pro-Putin candidate from a fringe party in Romania. Now, last week, the DC Circuit ruled in an important case involving TikTok and national security. And to speak to me about that, of course, is Glenn. So I'm super glad you're here. Thanks, Glenn.
Absolutely delighted to be back.
Tell us, what gave rise to this case before the DC Circuit?
So the immediate matter before the DC Circuit was an act of Congress enacted earlier this year that was a statute with the title of Protecting Americans from Adversarial Apps. That's not the exact title, but something close to it, that basically said that TikTok and other similar type apps that were controlled by a foreign adversary, which would include China, would have to be banned within 270 days or be divested and be held by a non-foreign adversary in order for them to continue to operate in the United States. I'm greatly summarizing the statute. TikTok immediately challenged that statute and said it was an unconstitutional infringement on its First Amendment rights, as well as its violation of other rights, equal protection clauses and other bill of attainder and a bunch of other legal arguments that they've mustered. And they went to the district court in the District of Columbia, a federal district court, and sought an injunction that was denied. That appeal was brought to a 3-judge panel of the DC Circuit Court of Appeals, which under the statute had exclusive jurisdiction to deal with this. And that court upheld the denial of the injunction, meaning that it allowed the law to continue to go in effect and said that the law was indeed constitutional. TikTok has immediately protested that and said that they wanted to appeal that failure to grant them an injunction or failure to set aside the statute itself as unconstitutional, and they wanted the Supreme Court to take a look at this. So they've now most recently filed a request before the DC Circuit asking the circuit to stay their opinion and let an appeal go ahead to the Supreme Court, which would be a petition for certiorari, which, as we all know, doesn't necessarily mean the Supreme Court has to hear the case. My guess is they probably would. And we'll see whether the circuit court goes ahead with that injunction.
So the law that you reference is something called the Securing the Information and Communications Technologies and Service, Technology and Services Supply Chain, which I think was originally an executive order followed on by Congress. The point of it being that we do not want foreign governments, I guess, controlling the communications backbone. In the case of TikTok, but also in the case of every social media platform, we continue to call them social media platforms, but they are data vacuums. They vacuum up every click, every hover, everything that you do, and they spin that off and they sell it to these people called data aggregators, many of whom are reputable American-based companies, but a lot of whom just go on and sell that God knows where. We don't really know where that data ends up. But there were multiple executive orders giving rise to this going back to the Trump administration when there were, you know, tension was originally focused on this. So tell us a little bit about what Congress did in sort of light of this executive order, but they also did something called the data broker law.
Right. Well, there are a couple of statutes at play here. Let's wind back the clock, so to speak, to President Trump's actions. President Trump, back in August of 2020, enjoined or issued an executive order that was aimed at TikTok, as well as another Chinese app called WeChat, which is a very popular app that is heavily used in mainland China and also used here in the United States by Mandarin speakers to communicate back home, among other things. In September of 2020, the United States District Court in San Francisco preliminarily enjoined the application of that Trump executive order, which would have banned it, saying, among other things, that there's a significant likelihood that the First Amendment rights of the users of WeChat would be infringed by this ban. So it was focused on the content users there. When President Biden came into office, he issued Executive Order 14034, which basically overturned President Trump's orders and said, stand by, I'm going to develop additional executive orders and statutes in this area. Those cases did not proceed. That wound up with the president issuing an executive order later on banning the bulk sale of Americans' personal data to foreign adversaries. And it also led Congress earlier this year to enact a statute that, again, as I said, was aimed both at TikTok by name, as well as other foreign-controlled adversaries. Interestingly, the statute did not cover applications and websites that were controlled by foreign adversaries that didn't have user-generated content or user-shared content, or had the primary purpose of allowing users to post certain types of reviews. So those were exempted from this new statute. And again, that's what TikTok was objecting to.
Let's give the bottom line here. What did the D.C. Circuit Court rule, this three-judge panel, which, by the way, for those interested, was Srinivasan, Rao, and Ginsburg?
You're right. It was a three-judge panel. There was an opinion of Judges Rao and Ginsburg in which Chief Justice Srinivasan concurred in part, but he also wrote his own separate 30-odd page concurring opinion. The basic question that was before the court was the First Amendment implicated by this statute that banned a platform? Again, think about this for a second. The statute wasn't aimed at any particular content. It didn't say you can say this or cannot say that. This was a statute that banned a platform itself and seemingly was content neutral. It talked about who owned the content. And it was clear from the evidence introduced at the initial district court hearing that this was aimed at making sure that content was not covertly manipulated by an adversary country, in this case, the PRC, and also, secondly, that the data of users was not siphoned off to an adversary, again, to Beijing, in effect. So the court looked at this, decided it was indeed a First Amendment issue. The analysis there wasn't all that detailed. They just didn't really talk about the arguments that I described earlier in the WeChat case, where they talked about the users having a First Amendment right. The case was pretty much focused on TikTok's right. And TikTok, after all, at least has an American owner at the first level. So there was a First Amendment issue here, even though it may ultimately be owned and controlled by a Chinese, there is an American entity in this. And then the question that the court proceeded to grapple with was, okay, if there is indeed a First Amendment issue here, we all know that the government can't restrict laws abridging speech except in very limited circumstances. And the question is, what is the standard of review that the court is going to apply given Supreme Court precedent in this area? And they're basically, just summarizing it greatly, there are three standards. One is the low one, which is government has to have a rational basis for infringing the speech or imposing some restriction. The second step up is that there's some level of intermediate scrutiny, which the court will allow an infringement on speech if it advances important governmental interests that are unrelated to that suppression of the free speech and doesn't substantially burden more speech than necessary. In other words, it's narrowly tailored to the task at hand. And then the next step up is a strict review, which means there's strict scrutiny. And that's if content is being infringed upon. And there, the ruling of the precedents is that the government is allowed to engage in that kind of activity, again, aimed at what would otherwise be free speech, if it serves a compelling government interest and is narrowly tailored to further that interest. Two of the judges decided, we're not going to look exactly what standard needs to be applied. We're just going to assume that the strict scrutiny standard applies And if the statute passes that, then we don't have to worry about whether we should have used the intermediate scrutiny. We've proven the more difficult case. Judge Srinivasan said, no, I think you should have used intermediate scrutiny. You need to address that higher standard. And even under that standard, he found that the government's interest was sufficiently strong to allow the action to proceed.
That was an excellent recitation. I'm so glad you walked through all three of those. And again, just to circle back, the legitimate government interest in this case that would allow us to use the medium range, if you will, standard is the national security interest that apparently the court was impressed that the government met, right? They proposed an excellent record, apparently, of what the national security threats are.
I would certainly say that TikTok greatly quarreled with that assertion. And I think an objective reading of the opinion would say that, yes, it's clearly true that there was a great depiction of the threat posed by China generally, their cyber maliciousness, et cetera. It's crystal clear that they are an adversary in many respects. But much of the actual indication that there really was a true potential for harm was in classified data that was not presented to the plaintiffs, to TikTok. TikTok complained about that in its motion for preliminary injunction, saying, you told us that this is a big threat, but you didn't tell us exactly how. You said there's the potential, but you, government, admit that it's not a current threat. You just said it's a potential, and you haven't told us how. So about all I would say about this is that, yes, it's crystal clear that China does represent a significant threat. Exactly what the immediacy of that threat is and the nature wasn't spelled out in the opinion, seems to be hinted at in classified information. And I think one would conclude that the court was at pains and expressly said, we're going to defer to the executive on this. We're going to take the executive's word at this. And one area in which the executive word is being taken is in the area where TikTok said, look, we proposed a national security agreement in which we said we'd address all the concerns of the government. We spent months and months and months coming up with an agreement with CFIUS, the Committee on Foreign Investment of the United States, and Department of Justice to come up with something that would meet the government's concerns. It was rejected out of hand, and we don't know exactly on what terms. And the court said, we're going to accept the executive branch's determination that even if that agreement was put in place, they couldn't trust China and TikTok to adhere to it. So the simple assertion that, yeah, you came up with a good agreement, but we don't think it'll work, is one that the court just accepted. And I think that's an interesting sign of deference to the executive branch in this area.
I think one of the more interesting features about this, there's some temporal context here. And I think it's important to say that the oral argument occurred before the revelations about China's presence on some of the major providers, which occurred in the weeks after. I guess what I took from this opinion, it was written before there was public information that the very thing that the government said China was doing and apparently was persuasive in its classified filing is now a matter of public. It's well known. And, you know, these things unfolded. Right. We can include in the notes to the cast a couple of links to public articles from major publications that discuss precisely what this is.
Can I just add one thing, just to be clear on my own position of this? Well, it's a bit nuanced. While I have some qualms about the opinion, I want to be crystal clear that I yield to nobody in my recognition of the threat posed by China in this area. I absolutely think it's a very serious national security risk. And I certainly accept that there could be, and probably well is, a classified determination of the nature of this threat as it relates to TikTok. I'm just simply saying that wasn't evidenced in the court's opinion. But I want to be crystal clear that I'm not particularly a fan of TikTok, and certainly feel very strongly about the very serious nature of the risk posed by China.
Yeah, given your professional history and sort of your experiences, I have no doubt about that. I guess, Glenn, one of the things that I thought was interesting about this opinion, too, is I just felt like we stepped over the Rubicon and we now had an opinion that sort of conducted an analysis of First Amendment and even the fixes here in a way that is not analog. And I must say, on just that narrow sort of understanding of how the digital space works, how code is written, how manipulatable it is, I was quite taken with the opinion generally because we talked about things like a kill switch. One of the solutions proposed was that the government would be able to sort of shut down TikTok if something went wrong. And, you know, that can be written against too. And maybe that can't be accomplished. And, you know, maybe the ongoing deployment of malware or, you know, the effects of cognitive warfare, which has been one of the things that people have been concerned about TikTok, was that it would amplify videos that just made us feel bad about each other and our country to the point where we're all just a little less engaged and care less. You know, they actually discussed these things. And I mean, you were at NSA, you get this stuff. Did you have that takeaway too? Were you just like, wow, something has just happened? We're having the kind of conversation I occasionally see out of the Ninth or the District Court in San Francisco and San Jose.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt that this opinion is important, not only because of the fact that it addressing TikTok, an app used by over 170 million Americans with an enormous practical and political consequence. But you're right. This is an opinion that is trying to deal in the First Amendment area with a law that wasn't aimed particularly at a type of content, but the very nature of the platform. And as you said, it's sort of aimed at the digital aspects of this, and because those digital aspects can be controlled and manipulated by a foreign adversary. I mean, I think one thing that's interesting, and TikTok has, of course, complained about this, is that the statute that was under review here didn't treat all foreign adversarial apps equally. It was particularly aimed at this social media one, and in particular, TikTok, because other apps that still would allow data to be gathered and data siphoned off to Beijing were expressly exempted under the statute and could continue to pose the threat that was supposedly the subject of this issue. And of course, even if a divestiture occurred and the statute were fully complied with, and let's just say an American entity bought TikTok, fulfilling the statute's divestiture requirements, and that American just happened to be, let's say, more sympathetic to the Chinese argument that China should be allowed to take over Taiwan, not an irrational opinion, not one I agree with, of course, but not an irrational opinion. And that person decided to allow the PRC to help manipulate data on the app now that it was controlled by an American, that would be perfectly okay on terms of the statute, would not invoke the statute at all. We'd have a bad result. So the court is grappling with this kind of problem. It's obviously some of the opinion shows some of the deficiencies in this area, but we don't have a legal system. The bottom line is we don't really have an integrated, coherent way of dealing with these digital threats. And instead, we're forced to deal sort of one-off with them in a very cumbersome and clunky way.
Also, with respect to the threat and sort of the having crossed over this sort of dichotomy in time, which is the, you know, analog, now we're dealing with a digital and highly dynamic threat, even if behind that dynamic threat is the actor that we know is a threat. One of the things that the opinion and the laws don't really deal with on the digital side of things is the collecting and selling of our data, because once it is gone, it's not a widget. It is something that is dynamic, moves through the ether, and we quickly lose control of, regardless of what laws we have in place. I think we were talking before we got started that TikTok does this, Facebook does this, like literally everybody does this. They're selling to data aggregators. You are the product as you're enjoying your videos. So can you talk a little bit about the difference here? Because like Mark Zuckerberg's doing it. How do we contain that if it all ends up in the same place anyway?
Yeah, so this is a serious issue. And I put the nature of the problem at the feet of Congress, which has for well over a decade failed to enact a basic privacy law. We're about the only industrialized democracy that doesn't have a base privacy bill, as you know. Europe led the way with the GDPR, as we know, and countries from India to Japan and even China have a base privacy bill. We do have a new statute now about the foreign transfers of bulk data to data brokers. We have some steps in that area and an executive order, but not everything is going to fit within the definition of data broker, et cetera. And there's a lot of holes in here. So we still have not grappled with in a coherent way with the fact that so much of our personal information is gobbled up by these applications, used for their profit, and enables arguably our privacy to be invaded, because even though some of it may be anonymously connected and anonymously gathered, the reality is, as we know, that it can be aggregated and you can develop individual profiles pretty easily, which I'm sure China is doing, at least in the case of people who, where they stole their OPM records back in 2015. We don't really have a system to address that. And part of that, I think, stems from two things. One, we have this ambivalent feeling about these apps. We love them. They're useful. They're fun. They're helpful. And we don't really want to do anything that would infringe on them, the utility of them. We like American innovation and creativity in this area. We don't want to crimp that. And also, there's the sense that it's out of sight. I mean, you don't really have an economic injury that you can feel when your data is sold and manipulated and used in whatever way, including simply as benignly as serving back to you an ad that you're more likely to click on because they know it's you. But we don't really feel a sense of outrage about this, and we're not quite sure exactly what our feelings are about privacy anymore in the digital age. And again, Congress has failed to try to address that and help eliminate some of that ambivalence. So we're stuck. On one hand, we hear lots of conservatives and some on the left too, complaining about content moderation, censorship by social media, suppression of voices, et cetera. And yet here we are saying we want to make sure that we don't have foreign influence here on our social media apps, but it's foreign influence of the sort we don't like, and other foreign influence might be okay. So there's a lot of ambivalence in this area.
The other thing that does change over time is who is the threat, which country is the threat. I mean, we have had troubled relationships with countries that then improved. And, you know, the other way around, we've had relatively good relationships with dozens of countries that we would, you know, suddenly had a shift in leadership, right?
And Exhibit A might well be Russia right now, which several years ago, we were very upset at their interfering in our election. The Senate Select Committee on Intelligence produced a 5-volume bipartisan report on how the Russia interfered with our 2016 election. And now with President Trump coming in, maybe that's not going to be of such a concern.
Right. It may or may not. And it also may be the case that people in the new administration know very well how these things go, but they view it in equipoise that it could have been anyone and it wasn't of our choosing. And I don't know precisely how people are processing this stuff, but let's talk for a minute about what the accusations have been, because that's a really nice segue. So TikTok has been in the news this week and less in the United States news, but I can tell you the Europeans, particularly Politico Europe and the Financial Times, Le Monde, all these papers, and of course, all the East European papers and the major Polish papers are covering what happened in Romania.
Extraordinary.
Where did this guy even come from?
It sounds like, I haven't been following the European news as probably as closely as I should have, but it certainly seems like at the direct instigation of the Kremlin, a sufficient number of, in fact, several thousand false accounts were created on TikTok and other social media apps that reinforced each other and replicated it and gave it a sense of legitimacy, boosting the candidacy of a far-right, previously unknown person, who is very much a pro-Putin candidate. And to everyone's surprise, he won in that first round of elections. The Romanian Supreme Court took the unprecedented step of annulling the elections. I'm not enough of a Romanian, no matter Romanian law to know whether that was appropriate or not, but it certainly attracted massive headlines in Romania, and they're now grappling with the fallout from this. But there's a very strong indication that his candidacy was indeed propelled and advanced by misinformation, disinformation, and content manipulation on TikTok as well as other programs.
When I looked a little bit more closely, what I did see was that under Romanian election law, the source of a campaign ad, they have a version of like a FARA type of thing. Mm-hmm. If it's coming from outside the country, that has to be disclosed. Furthermore, if it's actually a campaign ad, the fact that it is promoting a candidate for office likewise has to follow certain rules, and it didn't. But let's talk about, I've looked at some of these videos, Glenn, and I have to say I found them hilarious on some level. So the guy, Colin Georgescu, you might remember that famous video that Putin put out where he was riding a horseback without his shirt on and trying to appear this very sort of tough man of the people. Well, it's not that dissimilar. So apparently this guy, he's a 62-year-old guy, a panda-shaped fellow. And these were pictures that show him racing on a track with the body of maybe a 28-year-old, slender, far slimmer, and, you know, from the neck down. I mean, when I looked at it, it looked to me like it was an obvious manipulated video.
Yep, sure.
And then there was another one where he was on horseback wearing sort of one of those white shirts that they wear in the Romanian countryside. And the women wear a version of that dress with a babushka, and he's silhouetted with a white light to make him appear sort of godlike or heavenlike. And it's just, and then there's another one where he's on a martial arts studio and appears to be flipping a much younger, sort of more healthy looking guy on the ground. I mean, it was just, it was borderline hilarious. What did Churchill say about what would talk you out of a democracy was something like, you know, a 10-minute conversation with the average voter, and maybe he meant in Romania.
Well, but some of the content that I have seen, I haven't looked at it all, but some of the content did look very crude and amateurish. And so you wonder just how much of an effect it has. I imagine even that has some effect, but a lot more of the content was much more sophisticated with some of the fake accounts that in turn magnified some of these accounts about how the ultra-nationalist party was winning and was ahead in the polls. And then there would be accounts that would talk about how everyone is talking about the fact that these accounts are doing it, et cetera. And so it's sort of self-perpetuating and self-sustaining, which was quite deliberate. So some of this was sophisticated, perhaps some of it wasn't, but we're never going to know for sure exactly what the effect is. It stands to reason that these kinds of things, whether it's in Romania or the United States, would indeed have an effect.
No doubt. You know, one of the things that I observed this week is, you know, Huawei has now developed its own operating system to compete with Android and iOS. I wonder what kind of your reaction to that is. And I wonder if you see anything about that that may sort of inform what we see in terms of cases in the future, what some of the national security concerns. Did you have any reaction to that as a guy who's sort of dealt with these deeply concerning issues in your career?
Sure. It goes back to the point I said before, at the risk of repeating myself, which is that we do not have an integrated way, a coherent way of dealing with the risks presented in a digital world by an adversary country that in particular happens to be a near peer or perhaps surpass us in certain areas in this digital world. Just for example, the Internet of Things manufacturers that has, I don't know what percentage of the market, but a very, very substantial percentage of the Internet of Things devices. That's everything from thermostats in your home to those garage door openers that you can control halfway around the world to your Wi-Fi enabled refrigerator and toaster. I would venture to say a very substantial portion, perhaps the majority of them, use either Chinese hardware or software. They're all theoretically capable of having a surveillance component in them, certainly also capable of having data siphoned back to Beijing.
Well, they did in the show Silicon Valley, if you watched.
Exactly. So we don't really have a principled way of addressing this risk. We've allowed, perhaps under the banner of innovation and creativity and free trade and globalization, China to run away in this area, partly because they could do it more cheaply and it produces great benefits to us. It's nice that we can have a really cheap TP-Link router, by the way, again, manufactured in China. And it works really well, I will say. I don't have one in my house because of the security risk, but we've allowed ourselves to get into a position where we are dependent on Chinese technology, period, full stop. We're not going to turn the clock back. We're not going to eliminate all Chinese technology, nor should we. I mean, it does have a role to play, but we need a coherent way of figuring out which Chinese technology, whether it's in the form of social media or in the form of Internet of Things applications and services, are we going to allow in our country and take the risk that there could be manipulation, surveillance, data gathered inappropriately, and it's going to be up to Congress to address that. So far, the track record isn't great.
Yeah, so far they've had 43 hearings and we got a whole lot of nothing burger. But there was another item in the news that made me think of this conversation this week, which is that NVIDIA is now going to have significant competition. You know, a lot of the chips right now are export controlled, but they've been pulling them out of suitcases all over the world. But ByteDance, that same Cayman Island company that owned TikTok, the overlord of TikTok, they have now said that they're developing AI and AI chips, and they are representing, at least publicly, that they're on a par to compete with NVIDIA, which, by the way, now controls what market share I would just emphasize that with respect to NVIDIA, it has become essential to the U.S. economy.
You know, in some ways, we are seeing the limits of our sanctions policy. We sanctioned and essentially banned Huawei equipment in the United States, originally eliminated Huawei phones for the military. Then we took further steps in banning their gear. The FCC has an entire program now to rip out and repair Huawei and ZTE, another Chinese company, equipment in our telecommunications.
5G equipment, right? Especially.
Exactly. Yes. Congress just in the new National Defense Authorization Act just a couple of days ago, which hasn't yet passed Congress, but passed the House with $3 billion in there earmarked for telecom companies to get rid of Huawei and ZTE equipment. But, you know, as a consequence of the sanctions and ban, Huawei said, okay, if you're not going to sell us chips and allow us to develop ourselves in the U.S. market, we'll go figure it out ourselves. And sure enough, last year, they astonished people in the cybersecurity and chip industry by coming up with their Mate 60 smartphone, which had an advanced 7-nanometer chip built in China. And now, they don't have technology below, meaning smaller than 7. They don't have 6-nanometer, really, really super tiny chips, which, of course, Apple and others do. But it's only a matter of time, and we need to recognize that. One thing we might spend a minute on, I don't know if you want to go there, is sort of what's sort of next in the TikTok area and what's happening with...
Oh, yeah.
So
let's take a walk down that road.
Yeah, we started there. We should just wrap up here on that point, which is, as I said, there's now a request to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals that TikTok has said, please give us a preliminary injunction, which is what they had asked for originally, basically suspending the application of the act and the requirement that on January 19th, a divestiture be in place or the ban in effect occurs. We should talk for a second about what that ban is. And the Department of Justice has opposed that, saying, no, you had your day in court, no need for an injunction, the D.C. Circuit's ruled on this, et cetera. My guess is that the D.C. Circuit, given the importance of this and the novelty of it, will indeed allow a petition to go to the Supreme Court to see whether the Supreme Court takes this. That'll push this well past, I suspect, January 19th. And then, of course, by the way, we have no assurance that the Supreme Court would take it up. My guess is, again, for the same reasons, the Supreme Court probably would. They would want to issue a ruling in this area. This is an important issue. And that might be well into 2025 before we have a Supreme Court ruling. If, on the other hand, the D.C. Circuit says, nope, sorry, we've looked at this issue. We're just not going to give you an injunction and the law is going to go into effect, whatever it is, on January 19th, then the incoming administration on the morning of the 20th is going to be faced with the question of, do they enforce the law? But even if they don't immediately enforce the law, it may well have a drastic effect on TikTok. Why? Because the statute that would go into effect prohibits app stores and internet service providers from basically handling TikTok. That's not exactly what it says. I'm truncating it, but that's the essence of it. I can't imagine that the Apples and Googles and whatnot of the world would say, let's just take the risk that the Trump administration won't enforce this and when we'll take the risk of civil penalties? No way. So the app could well start to degrade or even go dark in certain areas on the morning of the 20th if there is no injunction. Not clear exactly if that'll be the case, but that's a distinct possibility.
And the party will be at Mark Zuckerberg's house.
Might well be, whose Instagram reels would benefit.
Yeah, most definitely. And quite frankly, we're seeing a real shift. I mean, one of the things about these platforms is they're popular for a while and then there's a sub. But anyway, I want to thank you so much. I'd like to have more of this conversation with you again in the future as these events sort of unfold before the court. And I'd like to also see what the new administration is going to do. And hopefully they won't just burn the house down thinking they'll start all over again. They might want to take a close look at some of this stuff. Well, give it
some
thought.
President Trump has said in somewhat ambiguous statements, as is his wont, that he wants to, quote, preserve TikTok. Exactly what that means isn't clear. We may have an opportunity to see that in January. My guess is, however, that this is going to head to an injunction and to Supreme Court review.
It'll be interesting. I mean, I would point out, and this is not to criticize or take any sort of partisan political view, but he has had a donor who was the original, you know, U.S. investor in TikTok, who gave a lot of money to his campaign. So I think that answer is actually pretty diplomatic. And I would add, I don't know if it's true, but CBS News reported last night that he invited President Xi to the inauguration. So I don't know if that's true, but I mean, is that the, I don't know if that's the ping pong tournament of this administration or not. It's interesting if that's actually correct. if there's trying to work towards some sort of thawing so that it's not mutually assured destruction. And by the way, there's a great Mel Blanc film, which depicts, I think it is Elmer Fudd and Bugs Bunny, you know, going after each other to the point where they destroy the entire earth and themselves. So hopefully we won't look like that. But anyway, I am glad to see you. I'm always glad to talk to you. And I hope you'll come back again in the future. We can sort of get a little bit more into this.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity. It is, as you've said, a very, very complex topic with lots of angles and issues that all need to be explored and no easy answers. Lots of good arguments on all sides here. I'm not just being diplomatic. This reflects the fact that these court cases are very, very tough, have lots of difficult issues.
We can't expect that every jurist understands how to write code or how code can be changed either. And I still come back to the fact that at some point we're going to need experts, I think, to help. And maybe that's what Congress needs before they can figure out a law.
One thing that's clear is the threat from China is not going to recede. And we need, again, as I said before, we need a thoughtful way of addressing that that still protects the things we need protected.
And on that note, anybody on the Hill who needs help drafting something, call Glenn. He can be reached at CSIS. All right. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much.
All right. Our guest tonight has been Glenn Gerstel. He is the former general counsel of NSA, but he can be found now on CSIS. I see him all the time on television. So thank you for listening to NSLT. Be sure to share this episode with a friend, a colleague. Remember to discuss these issues in a thoughtful way, hearing each other out. That's an important part of developing your skills as a lawyer. Even when somebody makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up, it might not be the worst thing to hear them out and understand people's point of view. If you had feedback for us, remember you can reach out to us on X at ABANATSEC. You can also reach out to us at nationalsecurity@americanbar.org. And just remember, our national security is really dependent upon our unity in a country more diverse in thought and other aspects than probably any other country in the world. Our writer and producer and host is me, Lisa Poteet. I am always here in my individual capacity. My editor and co-producer is the ever lovely Frances Burkham, now of Ohio. My co-producer is Holly McMahon, who is amazing on a bad day, as well as the incredible members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, including Mr. Gerstel himself, without whom this podcast would not be possible. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.